Did you spend a lot of time thinking about what your legacy would look like?
Well, I hope the legacy is that I kept my word, that I said that the reason I was running was to help change the life of ordinary people and reduce the prospect of war. And because of Vietnam. Some folks are born made to wave the flag. Ooh, they're red, white, and blue. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, ooh, they point the cannon at you. No, it ain't me. It ain't me. I ain't no senator, so. It ain't me.
This is mostly a protest. The fires have been started.
I love the smell of dementia in the morning.
I want you to get up right now.
The journalism industry is overrun with elite, underqualified, rich, entitled nepo babies.
How are you, baby? How old are you?
I don't know.
People should not be walking around with masks.
Russian disinformation.
Russian disinformation.
You're stewards.
I don't care who you are, if that doesn't get you up. I thought I'm doing a cute little funny intro and I'm just here like shaking a tambourine. That was Joe Biden giving an interview to Univision, a sit-down interview. He won't, of course, do this with anybody that will challenge him in our media. And he's standing in the Oval Office, and the interviewer asks him, he goes, have you thought about your legacy? And he says, you know, yeah, I hope that I leave a more peaceful and prosperous country because of Vietnam. The verbatim answer is, he ran to change the lives of everyday people and reduce the prospect of war because of Vietnam. A war that, for all intents and purposes, ended a year after he was elected to the United States Senate. That's how long Joe Biden has been in our lives. Or a few years before mine, I should say. Let's put that aside. Let's actually examine that. He wanted to reduce the prospect of war. And this is where a competent questioner that he has never faced. He has never faced a correction or a difficult question in his time in office. Not one. Let's look at that reduce the prospect of war. Since Biden has been elected, the Taliban was handed Afghanistan back in 11 days. Putin invaded Ukraine, which is by all intents and purposes a proxy war for the United States. Palestinians from Gaza under Hamas rule conducted the worst massacre of Jews since the Holocaust, resulting in what's going to be a pretty devastating outcome for them and under Biden as he now struggles to explain it to his lunatic base who doesn't think Israel should even exist. And let's not forget Canada is still up there doing its thing. I guess we could throw the migration crisis in there as well from, you know, supposed asylum in war-torn and ravaged third-world countries in Central and South America. And I guess we can talk about the fact that probably any day now China is going to take Taiwan. Way to go, President Carter. I mentioned the fact that he keeps telling stories that are long debunked and that the media just ignores. In particular, Daniel Dale of CNN, Glenn Kessler of The Washington Post. Biden tells a debunked story almost every single day, and they ignore it. Because, of course, they believe that democracy is at stake, and therefore Biden's Forrest Gump-like biography, where he just inserts himself into historical events like he's just living his life. His new one is that he's told is in this interview, he said he taught Second Amendment law at UPenn, and this is a debunked lie. He never taught a class at UPenn. He's never taught the Second Amendment. And he has never, as president in 3.5 years, ever had a journalists sit across from him and correct him and say, well, sir, actually, you say this, but this has been debunked, and here we have the thing, just to see what his reaction would be. Biden was in Wisconsin just a few days ago, and he said, quote, I, like an awful lot of people in this audience, was the first in my family to go to college. That is one that has been debunked since his campaign in the 80s. The first campaign where he pointed at a reporter and said, listen, Jack, and whatever, and said, I'm the first in my class to go. And they figured out that his grandfather played college football. And this was one of the plagiarized lies that he keeps telling that ended his campaign 35, 40 years ago. And it's just to the point to where the press just, let him say it. Except this, of course, is the same media that turned Trump's crowd inaugural size and a Sharpie fib into a two-week-long news cycle and treated even the smallest embellishment as a front to a free press and a First Amendment. That's great. That's how they should act. And here you have Biden, who, like I said, he has lied so much about his biography that we don't really know anything about him. He's the Kaiser Soze Forrest Gump of presidents. Whenever he gives an interview, he's verbal Kent looking at the board or just pulling stuff out, and the interviewer just, Vietnam. My son died face down in the muck, in the shit in Nam. It's April 10th. I want to play a bit from a podcast that Barry Weiss released called Honestly with Barry Weiss. It's a podcast that's hosted at the Free Press, and it's the accompanying podcast to her, to the essay by Yuri Berliner, which was also featured at the Free Press that I talked about yesterday. And there was one bit that I didn't get into, and I listened to this a bit yesterday after I recorded. And there was one bit that in the podcast that I think jumps out more than it would in a written piece. And that's Berliner talking about how NPR chose to cover the conflict with Israel and Gaza. And in a way, this is a humble brag that he basically says exactly what I predicted and what I said was going to happen. And as I've continued to say, is that they were going to downplay the attack. Of course, when it happened, it was going to be all over the news and it was going to be an outrage. And then they would downplay the attack because they knew Israel would retaliate. It was just a question of when. And so Berliner goes into how NPR chose to cover this in behind-the-scenes editorial before Israel even attacked or retaliated. And like I said, he confirms that the whole reason for downplaying it is so they could create the moral equivalency that Israel is the aggressor and that their reaction is over the top and over the line and they're committing genocide and there's 30,000 dead women, children, and poets in Gaza. And he all but confirms that. And I think this is better as a podcast. And one of the other things that struck me is I listen to Barry Weiss's podcast sometimes, is she's playing clips from NPR. And it's kind of this weird meta thing because she's very much like an NPR podcast, just well-spoken, well-versed, calm, kind of funny. And she inserted clips from NPR into her podcast. And then there's ads and everything. And I thought, God, this is so much different. Like, I had to jimmy-rig that clip of Creedence into the intro, and I'm kind of like the Happy Harry Hard-On pump up the volume of podcasts because I don't have a production team that can go and do all of that for me, and then I just kind of sit down at the table with the microphone. That's totally okay. I love being a little punk rock here and a little Rusty Shackelford from the basement with my just broadcasting shit out. But I wanted to play this clip. Where she interviews him. And I know there was a reaction that I'll get into for comments and questions on the podcast. Some of it's good, some of it's bad to him, that he's still part of the problem and that he, because he doesn't think defunding is the answer. I happen to disagree. I think defunding is a good place to start, at least. But here is that clip from Barry Weiss, Honestly, and this is the accompanying podcast that was released the same day as the column that Berliner wrote for the Free Press, which I thought was great. Like, they knew, like, the attention that was going to come on this, and it was kind of a big release, and it was a great rollout. But here he is talking about October 7th and NPR's reaction to how they should cover what was about to come.
On October 12th, 5 days after October 7th, this is how NPR described the attack. The war was sparked by a surprise attack from Hamas that saw fighters flow into Israel on trucks and paragliders. It has left at least 1,300 people dead in one of the worst attacks in Israel's history. So there's no mention of innocent civilians, no mentions of the brutality, and few details about 10/7. And they jump right to this. Israel's retaliatory airstrikes have killed almost as many Palestinians in Gaza in 6 days of war. More than half are women and children, and many are still buried under the rubble. How do you understand NPR's coverage of the war, and has it surprised you at all?
I don't think it surprised me. I think in a lot of respects, it's been really troubling. I do remember just on October 10th, this was 3 days after the attack, when Israel has not responded. This was in our union chat group. You know, we had one journalist saying, let's use this guidance from this Middle Eastern journalism affinity group about the language we use describing this war that's about to start. And it was, I said, no, we should not get our guidance from journalism advocacy groups. I don't think we should get our guidance from the ADL. No, we need to make our own decisions about how we cover this. I got a lot of pushback. People say, no, this isn't political. This is just using the precise language. But it was a very tense exchange.
I'm going to play a little bit more of this, but I wanted to cut it there because I think that this is interesting. It's like clearing everything with HR at NPR. And when they say we need to use precise language, that of course means how you describe Hamas, how you describe Israel. And he talks about the language of oppressed versus oppressor. And once you realize the political left, which is pretty much what NPR is, let's face it, they view the lens of everything through oppressed versus oppressor. If you've listened to this podcast, Weiss starts out with All Things Considered and the music and the things that she talks about staying in the driveway and finishing the story. And she paints this great picture, and she's better at it than I am, about what NPR used to be and how you grew up on it. And then he talks about how when he grew up on it, it just helps balance your day. You get fresh air, if you will. And then she goes into clips from recent about Robin DiAngelo and dealing with whiteness and gender. And she plays a segment that I couldn't believe, because I don't listen to NPR anymore for many of these same reasons, where they had a guest on who basically normalizes and rationalizes self-immolation in reference to the guy who lit himself on fire outside the embassy in solidarity for Palestine and killed himself. And they're rationalizing this and this whole segment on NPR where it's like, this is actually one of the nicest, safest, pure forms of protest one can actually participate in. It's insane. Been listening to the Versus Media podcast, free member version. To get the rest of the podcast, additional segments, as well as comments, questions answered on the podcast as part of the community, please consider joining one of my three subscriber tiers. There's a monthly, then there's a yearly, and then there's a founding tier as well, which I will participate in chats with members weekly and offer some other perks. You're always, of course, welcome to stay a free member here, and there's, of course, no obligation to subscribe. But you should, because that's where all the fun actually happens. This is the Versus Media podcast on Substack, and as usual, don't ever talk to journalists.